I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mayors from across the country are at the White House today, wish lists in hand. 60 mayors are meeting with President Obama to find out how much of the nearly $800 billion economic stimulus package they can expect. At the meeting, the president warned the mayors he will stop projects in their tracks if he feels the money's going to waste.
American people are looking to us, each of you, as well as myself and Joe and others in our administration, for leadership. And it's up to us to reward their faith.
Republican Pat McCrory, mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, joins us on the line now from the White House. Mr. Mayor, we understand you're in the East Room?
I am in the East Room right now.
All right.
I'm not going to be kicked out in a few minutes.
We'll take advantage of your time. WBT News Radio in Charlotte reports today that you said your city is getting the short end of the stick. So are you not happy with the way things are going?
I'm not happy with the transportation highway dollars on the way it's going through the governor's office. Because some of the governors, frankly, are distributing the money not based upon congestion or safety or traffic, but based upon easier parameters of shovel-ready, which aren't necessarily good for metro areas like Charlotte.
Well, so you want, you know, more to benefit your area, which is understandable. Well, the Charlotte Observer also reported that you had expressed opposition to the stimulus package. Are you now thinking, well, I might have been opposed to it before, but now I want some of that money for my town?
Oh, now that it's passed, it's our money. And I'm going to try to get as much money for Charlotte, because if we don't spend it, it'll be spent in Chicago or San Francisco or L.A. or Boston.
Well,
so that's money that's coming from Charlotte that now that the bill's passed, you know, I'm going to try to get our fair share to spend, hopefully, on sustainable projects that will benefit the next generation. The concern I have is that some of the shovel-ready projects won't be projects with longevity and sustainability. But I was very pleased to hear the president say today that he wants accountability for the projects.
In fact, the president said today to you, we understand that he would call you out, you mayors, if there's a project that wastes money.
I thought that was an excellent point he made, and I want to compliment him on that, because he recognizes that if money is wasted on pork barrel type of projects, that it will not give confidence to the American people. And he gave a strong warning to mayors, don't waste the money. And I agree with him 100%. I'm just afraid the bill does not protect you from that.
Well, we understand that you're looking for more than $800 million from the package, which you estimate will create about 23,000 jobs. What are your projects?
Well, we have projects in transit. We have a major mass transit program in Charlotte, which I'm very, very proud of, and it's been nationally recognized. And we want some money for transit projects, for road projects, and for water and sewer projects. I'm trying to concentrate on projects which will have long-term sustainability for the next generation, because the next generation is going to be paying for this bill.
I think the mayors as a group are moving through your room there. I just have one last question for you. We all know Charlotte is a major banking center, home to Bank of America, Wachovia, which Wells Fargo bought last year. Unemployment in your area is the third highest in the nation at around 9%. Some economists say it could hit 12 or 13% within a year. You know, the stimulus package renews an extension of benefits that President Bush signed, increases benefits for individuals by about $25 per week. You know, you may have been against some parts of the package, but aren't these benefits, these unemployment benefits extensions, your town needs?
Well, I think there are some unemployment benefits needed, especially regarding medical insurance, which I do support that portion of the bill. Extending unemployment medical benefits is, I think, going to be very, very helpful. There are parts of the bill that I totally agree with, but I just wish more money would have gone for infrastructure, because that's the way I think the president, frankly, would have changed, too, that because infrastructure, like what they did during the Eisenhower administration, has long-lasting value for generations to come, and if too much of the money goes toward operations, it'll be gone in 2 years. And to President Obama's credit, he gave also a very strong warning to mayors. Don't depend upon this money 2 or 3 years from now. And we better be ready for that. Whoever's around 2 or 3 years from now, we're going to have to fill those grants up with our own local money. And I commend him for his pragmatic points on that. But I know mayors and governors, too. Once you get the money, it's hard not to ask for it again once it runs out.
Mr. Mayor, one last question. When do you expect to get the money?
Well, they're talking about within the next 120 days. Our governor in North Carolina is already making decisions on road projects, which we're just getting notice of. You know, I've got to make do with what I have and give constructive criticism on things that I differ with, but also compliment those things that I think are working well.
Pat McCrory, Mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina. Mr. Mayor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, this week, housing was in the headlines with the president's announcement of his plan to stem foreclosures. And a timely book reminds us of another time when the dream of home ownership was also in the headlines. They called it Levittown. Actually, it was two instant suburbs built largely on a potato farm on Long Island and on spinach fields in Pennsylvania by the builders Levitt and Sons.
Well, Levittown, Pennsylvania is a prototype of a new kind of 20th century American living.
Rows and rows of homes were pitched to returning World War II vets, except if they were black. For blacks, Levittown was the equivalent of the front seat of the bus where they couldn't sit, which would make Bill and Daisy Myers the Rosa Parks of the North, because with the help of a white Jewish family, they became the first African Americans to move into a Levittown home in Pennsylvania in 1957, setting off an explosive, violent, and somewhat unknown chapter of the civil rights era. In a few minutes, we're going to meet Daisy Myers, but first, David Kushner tells her story in his fascinating new book, Levittown, Two Families, One Tycoon, and the Fight for Civil Rights in America's Legendary Suburb. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York. And David, first want to note, this story is personal for both of us. Your mother-in-law knew the Wexlers, that's the Jewish family who helped the Myers. But also, when I was very little, I lived briefly in Levittown, Long Island. But let's put this in context for people who don't know the towns. It's post-war America. There weren't enough affordable homes. You write veterans were sleeping in chicken coops?
Literally. People were advertising ice boxes that veterans can come live in. So on the one hand, it was a great time. I mean, it was post-war and there was a boom and all this. But the fact was the veterans were coming back and they had nowhere to live.
And into that void comes the Levitts, the builders Abe and his sons William and Alfred, who became heroes for their ability to churn out houses. Why? What was their thinking?
They were brilliant businessmen. Part of that was marketing and giving people what they needed and wanted. And what people really wanted was the American dream. And the American dream being a house in a good community with good schools and all that. But even better, they knew how to deliver it. And they delivered it by building homes, applying the mass production that had been seen in the auto industry to churn out homes affordably, and also using the GI Bill to help finance this.
I have vague memories of this, and it's part of family lore. The houses were something like $5,000 to $7,000, and the GI Bill gave returning vets, like my dad, $5,000. So voila, they have this home. And the latest appliances, there was a television in a wall under the stairs.
Exactly.
And all the houses looked exactly alike, so our mothers had to tie different colored bows to the doors so we'd know where we lived. And there was this incredible dream of a pool in the middle of a shopping center in every neighborhood. But blacks were barred. I have no memory of that or of it even being discussed. How well known was that?
A lot of people didn't know. It took me years of researching this to connect all the dots and really discover just the astonishing depths of it and how stubborn Levitt was. In particular, Bill Levitt ended up being the front man for all of this. He was a bit like the P.T. Barnum of the American Dreamtown.
Well, at one point, when the contracts were first drawn up, it was actually in the contract. Then it wasn't. You know, I'm trying to remember, my mom has passed, but I remember she had a dear black friend, Sweetie Nicholson, but come to think of it, we always went to see her at Roosevelt Field. She never came to see us. So who knows how much it was known to them, but what did the Levitts say about it?
This was not Levitt's invention, and this is an important point. It actually started with a homeowners loan corporation back in the 30s when they were pumping billions of dollars into the market, and they determined that communities would be most stable if they were homogenous. That meant containing the same racial and social class. So later, the Federal Housing Administration actually recommended racial covenants. And Levitt was just among the many, many, many builders in America at this time following these guidelines.
It was thinly veiled racism, and it became sort of the blueprint for American cities and suburbs, that there was redlining and loans were getting given out in certain areas and they weren't in others.
In 1948, the Supreme Court ruled that racial covenants were unenforceable. And what Levitt did was he removed the clause that said, you know, it had to be whites only. But then he went out and made a statement saying our policy, however, is unchanged. Not only were they not selling to African-Americans, they were not selling to African-American veterans.
And Levitt said, he was very open. He said, He didn't believe he was a racist. He believed that if he sold to African Americans, he would never be able to sell to whites.
Yeah, he did feel that it was basically white flight, and his family, they were also pioneers of white flight. I mean, he told a story of how they left Brooklyn after a black DA moved in next door. So they believed this, and he did compartmentalize and said, you know, I can either build homes or fight for civil rights, and I'm a builder.
Well, and it was a two-pronged fear that the Levitts had. On the one hand, race. They were equally afraid of communists. And in fact, the Levitts firmly believed that home ownership would cure communism.
Absolutely. And another little-known fact in all of this was that Levitt's man in Washington was Joe McCarthy. And he had gotten onto this issue of housing and public housing as being, you know, a kind of a breeding ground for communists. And he was very supportive of the idea of Levittown, and because he felt that this is a way to fight against communism. And Bill Levitt actually then came out and made a very famous statement where he said, you know, essentially, no man has time to be a communist when he owns a house.
And has to mow his lawn. As required by the Levitts, they were sticklers about how their area was going to look. You had to mow your lawn. You had to keep it a certain color green. Well, enter into your story then. The Wexler family, your mother-in-law's friends, they'd been communists. But like many progressive communists, they were in the Bronx fighting for workers' rights. In 56, I think it is, when they hear Khrushchev's famous speech detailing the horrors of communism under Stalin, at least B. Wexler, the mom, quits cold.
This was a turning point, but it actually happened to coincide with the time when they had just moved to Levittown and discovered that there was a fight there to be had.
Because there they meet residents and Quakers concerned that there are no black families in Levittown, and the Wexlers help broker a deal to sell the house next door to them to Bill and Daisy Myers, a black couple they knew, which set off race riots and daily protests outside the front door of 43 Deep Green Lane. David, thanks so much for setting the scene for us. David Kushner, author of Levittown, Two Families, One Tycoon, and the Fight for Civil Rights in America's Legendary Suburbs. And let's now meet Daisy Myers. Today she lives in York, Pennsylvania, where once the neighbors banged their garbage can lids to annoy the Myers before they realized they knew Bill Myers because he was from York. And from York, of course, they moved to Levittown. Daisy, welcome. Thank you. And I'm just wondering, first of all, your thoughts on this book being published with your story. How do you feel about it getting this attention now?
Well, I thought the true story should be told, and I was the one who could do it.
Well, and remind us who you were when this story unfolded. You grew up in the South in a loving, thriving black community, but you were very aware of racism. How did you feel about moving to Levittown before you moved?
It was a matter of necessity. I had a young daughter, and I didn't have but two bedrooms, and I needed an extra bedroom. So that was the main reason we considered moving.
Simple as that, but it became very difficult. Daisy Myers, we're up against the break, but we're going to come back in 1 minute. We want to find out what it was like to have a race riot outside your dream home, to be viewed as such a hero that Martin Luther King wanted to meet you. We'll do that. Also later today, a cautionary tale about rationing drugs. But back in a minute with Daisy Myers, Here and Now. Welcome back. We're meeting Daisy Myers. She and her husband Bill and their three kids were the first blacks to move into Levittown, Pennsylvania in 1957. Levittown had a policy of excluding blacks. It was called racial steering. Real estate agents would steer blacks, you know, somewhere else, even after that was clearly against the law. And Daisy, you were just saying you moved to Levittown for the same reasons a lot of white families did. You needed more room. And your husband, Bill, we should add, who was a veteran, liked to work on things, and he wanted a garage. So you were like a lot of young post-war families. But did you also feel at all that you were going to be at the vanguard of something bigger than that?
Absolutely not.
Can you describe some of these scenes we read about in the book, people outside the house? What was that like? There's a picture of you holding your little girl, looking out the window at everyone outside. What was that like?
We were a very private family and certainly not accustomed to having people looking in our windows and standing on the sidewalk and so forth. So it was completely a surprise. In fact, if we had any indication that it was going to be what it turned out to be, I doubt very seriously if we would have moved in there.
I don't think anyone would, private or not, would,
right.
You know, would want people throwing rocks, jeering, you know.
Name calling.
I didn't even know that people said names like that in places like Levittown. And I should say to you that I actually, as a small child, lived for a few years in Levittown, Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And in reading the book, you know, it was really quite a shock. Both my parents are passed, and I wish I could ask them what they knew about this.
Right.
You quickly discovered, though, that in addition to, you know, some of the ugliness, there were a lot of people who reached out to try to help you. Tell
exactly.
us about that, yeah.
Yes, and next-door neighbors, the Wexlers, they were very helpful, and we had other friends who lived there also, so it wasn't a completely new situation.
We mentioned some of the things people did to you, you know, the racial epithets and riding around with Confederate flags. What are some of the things people did for you?
Oh, we received all kinds of gifts and baskets of fruit, flowers, and there were quite a few people who wanted us to be there as much as those who didn't want us to be there.
But yeah, how scary was it? At a certain one point, people affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan bought the house behind you. They're having wild parties all night to try to disturb you.
And loud music.
How frightened were you?
My husband and I were very close to each other. We had good faith in each other. Every night before we went to bed, we said a prayer in the event we didn't wake up the next morning. We were always close, so I felt as though he had me and I had him, and that was all we needed at the time.
But this is at a time in the mid-50s when also in the headlines were lynchings in the South, firebombings,
exactly.
Churches being firebombed.
Yes.
I mean, and you had three little kids. Were you worried?
Yes. I was more worried about them than I was about ourselves.
Did this surprise you as a daughter of the South? Now, Pennsylvania, you know, is certainly further south than where we are in Boston. But did this surprise you that this was going on in what some people would call the North?
Very much so. But I had no way of knowing that because I was raised and schooled and everything in the South. And as the people used to say, you knew where your place was, you know, and we weren't accustomed to breaking any laws or anything.
Or breaking any ground.
Right, exactly.
You had to sit in the back of the bus and all of that, and here
exactly.
you think, well, I'm going to move into America's greatest suburb, and then you find this. You went back to Levittown, Pennsylvania, in 1999. I think your husband had passed at that point.
Right.
And they had a ceremony. They dedicated a 16-foot blue spruce tree. There's a plaque at the base that says, Miss Daisy. The Bristol Township apologized for what happened in 1957. What was that day like for you?
It was sad and happy also. But the people of the township were very, very nice to us. We had other close friends who were there, and it was really, really a wonderful occasion.
Was it enough?
I would think so, yes.
It was enough.
Who's to say what's enough and what's not enough?
And how do you feel about Levittown today? It's still, we understand in Pennsylvania, it's still overwhelmingly white. I think 3% of the population is African American. Does this mean that your fight was for naught, or how do you interpret that?
No, I think it was very successful. I think people who want to live there now can live there in peace and not have to worry about any of the issues that we had to worry about.
And what about your legacy? People have said you're the Rosa Parks of the North. How would you look at yourself?
Just an ordinary citizen, that's all. I'm not Rosa Parks, and I don't have any feelings that I want to be Rosa Parks. But I feel, and my family feels very lucky that we were able to stay there as long as we wanted.
Well, you may not feel heroic, but you met Martin Luther King, and we understand you said to him, it's so nice to meet you, but what did he say to you?
He said, I was anxious to meet you, which surprised me because I was a nobody, you know.
Oh, not quite. Not quite. Daisy Myers, what do you think of Bill Levitt, the man who, you know, created both Levittowns, who built and designed them implicitly to keep blacks, Jews initially, out? If you could say something to him today, what would it be?
I think he just wanted to make money, and he did. I have no ill feelings at all towards him.
Really?
No. I'm a Christian.
Well, Daisy Mars, thank you so much for speaking with us. What a pleasure.
Well, you're quite welcome, and it's very nice to talk to you.
By the way, we're getting emails from children of African-American veterans who say they were well aware of the story of Levittown. Sheila Sinclair is one. She's just written. And by the way, Bill Levitt, the powerful Levitt son, eventually sold the Levitt Company, but he lost all of his money in other real estate deals. He died destitute, unable to pay his debts in 1994. In 2007, the National Association of Home Builders enshrined Bill Levitt in its Hall of Fame, calling him the father of suburbia.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky little boxes.
In 1962, Malvina Reynolds wrote this song lampooning the development of American suburbia, perhaps for many represented by Levittown.
And a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Still ahead, three cartoonists weigh in on race. After the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's a little notice provision in the Obama administration stimulus plan to study what some say is health care rationing and others say is a way to streamline, to determine the best treatments and procedures for disease. People who support the $1 billion study say it will bring uniformity to the doctor's office. But critics say it's the first step towards government deciding who gets what drugs and treatments and when. The rationing of breast cancer drugs is the topic of an article in this month's Atlantic magazine. It's called My Drug Problem, and it was written by Virginia Pastrell, a contributing editor and columnist for The Atlantic. In it, Virginia tells the story of her recovery from breast cancer using the expensive drug Herceptin, which cost her U.S. insurer $60,000 for a year of treatment. But she found that in New Zealand, the drug is rationed. Virginia's editor wanted her beginner story with the line, "If I lived in New Zealand, I'd be dead." But she discovered it's a little more complicated than that. And Virginia joins us from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for writing about this. Your breast cancer, a lot of people know all too well after the initial discovery of a lump. There can be other discoveries made. That happened to you. Take us through it. What happened?
Yes, it did. My breast cancer was identified in a routine mammogram as part of my annual physical. I had no symptoms. And I found out that, in fact, the cancer was much worse than it had appeared on the initial mammograms and ultrasound.
And this is where the drug Herceptin comes in. What do the studies say about its effectiveness? What was the hope of what it would do for you?
Well, first of all, my particular kind of breast cancer is what is called HER2-positive breast cancer, which is a particularly aggressive kind. There is a genetic marker that they can test for. And this is the fact that there is a diagnostic test is important when talking about cancer drugs and their costs. Because once you've diagnosed somebody with HER2-positive breast cancer, you have a pretty good idea that this drug Herceptin will work very effectively, particularly in an early case like mine.
So you become a candidate for Herceptin and learn that it's expensive, and patients usually take a certain number of doses. I think it's 17. Tell us more about that.
The standard Herceptin dose is to take it every 3 weeks intravenously for a year. So when I was having chemotherapy, I had it along with every 3 week course of chemotherapy. When the chemotherapy was done, every 3 weeks I would still go in for Herceptin. That is the treatment in most countries. It's the treatment in Canada and France and Germany, etc. But what I discovered when I started researching this article is that in New Zealand, which is a very small country, but an affluent one, Herceptin has been a very big issue in recent years.
You learned that New Zealand has a government panel, PharmAC, which evaluates drugs and decides which are cost-effective, you know, negotiates the prices. And you're now linking to another debate we know is going on in the cancer study world. They recommend that this drug be used closer to end of life than beginning stages, the discovery stages. Given that knowledge, how is Herceptin given out in New Zealand?
First, for a long time, the government insurance program wouldn't cover it. People could get it if they paid themselves because PharmAC and the pharmaceutical company were unable to come to an agreement on the price. Then actually in July 2007, under enormous political pressure, Pharmac said, yes, they would fund the drug. They would fund it for 3 treatment cycles or 9 weeks. And this is based on a small Finnish study that found women who were given a treatment like this, there did seem to be significant progress. It did seem to work.
Now, you also spoke to specialists who said, no, we don't agree that 3 is enough. We think the 17 is best. But at any rate, women in New Zealand are then what, having to pay $4,000 per dose if they want the extra doses?
Right. It's quite expensive.
So you came to the conclusion that, unlike your editor's suggestion for the first line, if you lived in New Zealand, you wouldn't be dead, but you would maybe, be poorer?
Be poor. And the other important thing is that if every country were like New Zealand, and that is very tight-fisted about funding new drugs, we would all be worse off and my prospects would be much less. That, you know, we in the U.S. are, in a sense, subsidizing the rest of the world because we are very lavish with our funding of cancer drugs. And other drugs as well, but it's particularly noteworthy in cancer. And we're a very big market.
But your story is also a cautionary tale about cutting medical costs. You found out how other countries make decisions about cancer drugs. Now, you note that Herceptin was quickly approved in the United Kingdom and Canada because of political pressure from breast cancer patients, so Herceptin is fine there. But in the UK, where the National Health System also studies and recommends drugs, there's a controversy over other cancer drugs, like kidney cancer drugs, and something called topping up. What's that about?
Right. So when you have very expensive cancer drugs, the NHS has said, we don't think they're cost effective. We're not going to pay for them. So then the question comes, well, suppose I can pay for it myself. Well, what the NHS, at least in some parts of the country, was saying was, if you do that, you not only have to pay for that drug, we're going to kick you out of the whole system for all your cancer treatment. So, for example, you're going to have to cover all your radiation therapy, which is extremely expensive. You're going to have to cover all your surgery costs, which are extremely expensive. It was all or nothing. Huh. And this was very controversial because people say, wait a minute, I've been paying taxes all my life into the NHS. You know, just because I'm willing to drain my savings to pay for this cancer drug doesn't mean I have the resources to pay for all my therapy. Why are you making me have this terrible choice? So the politics of it worked out that the government said, okay, you can do what they call top up. We'll let you stay in the NHS for the rest of your cancer treatment. But you can pay for your drugs, and we won't kick you out for your other treatments. However, we don't want the spectacle of having two people, you know, sitting there getting different treatments. So
in the same room.
So if you're going to get the cancer drug and pay for it yourself, you have to do it outside the system. This is sort of a compromise.
So what conclusion do you draw in the end?
The bottom line of the article is really that, because we know all the faults of our system, we tend to think that somewhere out there, there's somebody who's got the right answer, that there is a right answer about what drugs should be given and what they should cost and when they're cost effective. And for the most part, you know, there isn't. There are political, economic, personal, emotional factors involved.
That's Regina Postrel, contributing editor and columnist for The Atlantic. Her article is entitled My Drug Problem. It's the story of her breast cancer and her research into the drugs available for breast cancer. Virginia, thanks so much for telling it here.
Thank you.
And by the way, quick note, Monday on Here and Now, President Obama is expected to overturn Bush-era restrictions on embryonic stem cell research. We'll check in with a leading researcher. You're listening to Here and Now. Yesterday, the Uber tabloid New York Post apologized for that cartoon that conflated the shooting of that poor chimpanzee with the passage of the stimulus package. If you haven't seen it, two cops stand over a chimpanzee they've just shot and say they'll have to find someone else to write the next stimulus bill. Well, that was followed by protests by people who felt the chimp was an age-old racist symbol, this time of the new black president. Well, on Monday, before the cartoon came out, hundreds of people came to the JFK Library here in Boston for a panel on editorial cartoons that I was privileged to moderate, and the topic of race came up there as well. We'll hear first from Dan Wasserman of the Boston Globe and Mike Lukovich of the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. I began by asking Dan if the first black president made it difficult to caricature a man without seeming to caricature a whole race. He said no.
I do know that this is a discussion, though, that's going on around the country. I think it's a squeamishness among editors. I think the country is still trying to get used to this idea. There are cartoons that have been killed because editors thought that cartoonists were drawing Obama's lips too big. I've looked at the cartoons. I don't see that. I mean, it's something that we all as cartoonists have talked about at some length.
Well, you know, I was reading something I think you said, Mike, about how it's hard to, although you want to have diverse cartoons, Americans are used to reading into that.
No, you know, when it comes to just drawing a normal cartoon, if I put an African-American in the cartoon, if it's just two people talking, sometimes it has a potential of becoming a cartoon about race rather than just a comment between two people on something. Now, the thing is having Obama as president has really, that's kind of going away. I mean, there's something about him. He's so inclusive. That's becoming less and less of a factor.
Last to speak, Joel Pett of the Lexington Herald Reader in Lexington, Kentucky. I thought I'd heard him comment earlier that he liked to tweak readers about race. Did I hear you say that earlier?
I think what you heard me say was, I'm offended by your question.
Okay.
You know, it's not like the guy's an affirmative action hire. He was the best person for the job. This discussion about race and drawing it and stuff, we've had this like 35 years ago in the business. It's just not an issue anymore. There's no reason for anybody anywhere to interpret anything. I mean, people interpret editorial cartoons widely. But, yeah, I just put, like, my random couples, you know, I try to, like, just find the goofiest combination of, you know, lesbian, handicapped, you know, turban-wearing, just, like, anything, anybody, and if somebody reads something into that, that's like their prejudice going, well, why does this guy have a turban? And you're like, because like a billion people wear them. Well, I don't know why. Ask him, you know? So that's a terrible answer. I'm sorry.
No, it's what I expected, Joel. Of course, 2 days after that panel, Sean DeLonis's chimp cartoon appeared in the New York Post. Joel Pett is on the line. Joel, care to adjust your response?
Well, first of all, that's a really dirty trick to make people accountable for their own words. I don't know what kind of journalism you practice up there in New England, but, you know, the guy was either so insensitive as to not be able to anticipate this reaction, or he anticipated it and just didn't care. So either way, it's a terrible cartoon, and there's a reason you've never heard of Sean DeLonis or seen his cartoons reprinted anywhere. You know, we had these little blow-ups about cartooning. You know, the cartoons about Muhammad a while back, the New Yorker cover, and now this. And meanwhile, the entire craft of cartooning is dying quickly.
Well, we should say you're the past president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. It is a very small elite group. How many around the country?
Maybe 80, all 80, former right. presidents.
Well, you all, though, profoundly believe in free speech. So what happens with something like this? Because you go to battle and bend around a cartoonist who's being attacked. This seems like a very different case.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between free speech. You can draw a stupid racist cartoon and walk around the street showing it to people if you want to. But that doesn't mean that you necessarily get a place in the profession and get paid for it. If you do that, then you got to expect to be held to some kind of standard of decency, really.
And by the way, we should say Sean DeLonis has said the chimp in his cartoon was not meant to symbolize Barack Obama. If anyone, he said, it symbolized House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but it didn't symbolize her either.
Not sure. I didn't see a purse.
Joel Pett, editorial cartoonist for the Lexington Herald Leader. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Back in a minute. Here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. This weekend, the Oscars. And one of the films nominated for Best Short Documentary is unexpectedly timely. The Conscience of Nem N centers around a prison in Cambodia, where between 1975 and 79, thousands of Cambodians were tortured and killed by the Khmer Rouge, who murdered an estimated 1.7 million people in all during their bloody genocide. This week, the Khmer general known as Doik, the commander of the Tuol Sleng prison, became the first senior Khmer Rouge official to go on trial. It's a moment the few survivors of his prison, some of them participants in this film, have long been waiting for. Stephen Okazaki is the filmmaker behind The Conscience of Nem N. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's talk about the name in your title, first of all, Nem N. He was the 16-year-old who took pictures for the Khmer Rouge. Why did he take them?
Well, he was trained to be a soldier, and then he was told, you're going to be the photographer. There's not a clear answer to why they needed the photos. I think, you know, it somehow gave form and process to the violence and the cruelty. And so they, you know, wrote down people's names, their birth dates, what village they were from, and they took ID photos of them. And for some reason, the photos look like portraits as opposed to ID photos.
They
do. There's something extraordinary about them.
They're kind of sepia-toned in some cases, and they are of Cambodians of all ages. These photographs, or, you know, portraits, as you say, line the walls of the prison, which is now a museum, and this is where you speak to Nem N. Nem N tells you that we had to have a record of who our enemies were, and he says he was just following orders. We also meet through your film some of the survivors of the prison, and one, Chum Mei, goes with you and your camera back to this tiny little cell. Could you describe that scene?
Chum Mei was tortured for about 4 weeks, perhaps a little longer, and every night he was put back in his cell, and the cell is about 2 feet by 6 feet, and he, in the film, goes back to that cell and describes it.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the murderous Khmer Rouge overthrew the U.S.-backed government in Cambodia and then became uber-communists who were determined to create a peasant society. They wiped out anyone who they thought might have any connection with the West. Chum Mei and his family were some of those brought into the prison. When you take him back to his cell, there's a moment where he breaks down and illustrates how even decades later, you know, nobody really understands what the Khmer Rouge's point was. Let's listen. It's in Cambodian, but here Chum Mei is saying, why did they bring me here? They killed my family, tossed them away like trash. If I were guilty, I might understand, but I didn't know what the CIA or the KGB was. Stephen Okazaki, that's hard to hear, even at this distance. What was that like for you?
Well, you really can feel his pain. I mean, I had never been to Cambodia before we started the project, and it was 30 years ago that this happened. But what was remarkable for me is the day I got into Phnom Penh, we were driving to the hotel and then driving to sites, and I would look out on the street, and people seemed to be just standing there with these sort of angry glares on their face. And I went up to a shrine at the killing fields, and there was a Cambodian woman there, and she also sort of glared at me, and then I kind of gave her a little bow, and she immediately smiled, and I realized, well, it wasn't anger that I was seeing, it was fear, and people's first reaction is fear, and this fear from 30 years ago is still very alive there, and people only now feel courageous enough to step forward and tell their stories. It's amazing the degree of fear in the culture and how devastated the country is, and you can hear that in Chum Mei's voice.
Well, Chum Mei is 77 now, and he's quoted in the New York Times this week as saying that he's still afraid of Doik, the general who ran that prison, who tortured him, who's on trial this week, and he's still unable to look him in the eye at pretrial hearings. And yet he says, if I survived the Khmer Rouge, and if I die before the trial, what was the point of surviving? They've been living, many of them, for this moment.
Yeah. You feel it everywhere that, you know, people have tried to come, you know, to terms with it and keep going. But there is this really strong sense of that, you know, we need some kind of justice. People want some acknowledgement for what they suffered through.
What's your sense of how much justice they will get? Because, again, we go back to Nem En, the man at the center of your film, the man who at 16 took the photos for the Khmer Rouge, is now a government official. You and your interpreters press him about his complicity, and he gets very defensive. He says, what was I supposed to do, free them? He would have been killed. And he says, in fact, my photographs now are proof of genocide. But what is this like for Cambodians? I mean, who's considered guilty in modern-day Cambodia? How are former Khmer Rouge backers, like Nem En, living alongside former victims?
Well, I think that people have been afraid of the Khmer Rouge so long that that fear still exists, and people are afraid to confront them. And the Khmer Rouges, the former Khmer Rouge people, we have one man in the film who admitted to someone we were working with that he had been part of many killings. And when we got there, he said, "I saw nothing. I did nothing. Right. I was nobody." So it's I don't know.
I mean, but given that a photographer for the Khmer Rouge, Nem En, is in the government today, what is the sense that there will be a fair tribunal?
Well, I think there has been a lot of protest among Cambodians that the trials are too symbolic. They've taken the five leaders that are still alive and the people that ordered the killings, but many of the people that committed the mass killings, and I can't even describe the killings. They're so horrendous. But that those people are walking around, those people are pretending they weren't with Khmer Rouge, and many people feel that they need to take the trials further. And many people are upset that, you know, Cambodia is so poor that the people in prison are, you know, eating and sleeping more comfortably than, you know, 90% of the population.
Or their prison guards. Well, I want to ask you one last thing as a filmmaker, because a centerpiece of the film is the photos, these really beautiful portraits, people locking, you know, a gaze with the camera just and with the person looking at the photograph now decades later. And we see all of these different faces, young people, old people, some smiling, some look afraid, some look determined, some look angry. And it seems as if you juxtapose those with the way you end the movie, just several minutes of faces of modern-day Cambodians, again, looking right into the camera. What are those faces saying to us?
Well, I think Nem En is correct in the film when he says that, you know, people wouldn't care, wouldn't know about this if it weren't for the photos. And the photos are just remarkably compelling. I mean, it's what you look like when you know you're about to die. So I wanted to end the film. I mean, the film is difficult and it's kind of a journey for people. But I wanted to end it with, you know, what was my experience when I acknowledge people and talk to them, you know, that glare, you know, they turn back into real people. And so I wanted to just show that there's still life and lots of life in Cambodia. And the point, I think, of the ending of the film is that, you know, no matter what, life does go on for the survivors.
That's Stephen Okazaki. His film is The Conscience of Nem En. It's nominated for Best Documentary Short in the Oscars this Sunday night. Stephen, by the way, congratulations and best to you in continuing to tell this story.
Thanks so much.